And now to a Texas country music singer and his take on illegal immigration. From the Western Folklife Center, here's another installment of What's in a Song.
I'm Tom Russell. I'm a singer-songwriter that resides right now in El Paso, Juarez, right on the border there.
I got 800 miles of open border right outside my door. There's Minutemen in little pickup trucks who've declared their own dang war. Now the government wants to build a barrier.
This matter of the government building a barrier or a wall along the border was coming up. And for some reason, the first thing that happened in my mind was they're going to build a barrier, and most of the cheap labor along the border is by illegals. Who's going to build the wall if you kick them out? My first feeling was that the government was trying to deal with terrorism, a very real thing, you know, after 9/11, by putting a lot of heat on Mexican Americans and illegal Mexicans, which in my mind aren't the problem, but they've been made the problem all of a sudden. Mexicans who are over here doing jobs a lot of Americans won't do, and doing them very well, by the way.
So don't lay that rap on me.
The danger in the song was thinking I was taking a cheap shot at the government, which isn't where I'm at, because I want to be honest about it. I don't have any politics one way or the other. It just doesn't interest me. I turn my gun barrels on the people I dislike, which are white developers who have used these people and then are the first to jump on the bandwagon and say, yeah, we got to get rid of them now.
It's the fat cat white developer who's created this whole damn squall. It's a pyramid scheme of dirty jobs, and who's gonna build your wall?
I'm being cliché-ic here in a way, but I've seen the same sort of person in city council just wiping out tens of thousand acres of land to put McDonald's in. And I just kind of think, let's see who the heroes are, and are the Mexicans really our enemies? And so it's a complex issue that I'm making kind of a cartoon about, but people identify with it a little.
Who's gonna wax the floors tonight down at the local mall? Who's gonna wash your baby's face? Who's gonna build your wall? Yeah, who's gonna wash your baby's face? Who's gonna build your wall?
What's in a Song is produced by Hal Cannon and Taki Telenitis of the Western Folklife Center. To post your views on illegal immigration and what should be done about it, go to npr.org/soapbox.
Our feature, What's in a Song, is produced by the Western Folklife Center, with support from the R. Harold Burton Foundation.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Today, it's hard to visualize the extent of the 1988 fires. The views in Yellowstone are stunning. Blue, cloudless skies stretch endlessly over the rugged landscape. Clear, sparkling streams and rivers cascade down mountainsides and through meadows. Geologic wonders like geysers dot the park, ejecting fountains of steam and water high up into the air. But the attractions in Yellowstone aren't only natural. Some are man-made, like the Old Faithful Inn, a century-old log cabin hotel.
The Old Faithful Inn was constructed of lodgepole pine, harvested here in Yellowstone Park, approximately 4 miles south of the site. The wood was cut by hand, dragged here behind horses, and it's the wood that grows around us here at the Old Faithful area.
Ruth Quinn works at the Old Faithful Inn and knows its history inside and out.
The idea was to bring us inside the building, but give us the feeling we were standing out in the forest.
She explained that the inn was built as part of a system of grand hotels throughout the park. Wealthy travelers would arrive by train in Gardner, Montana, at the north entrance to Yellowstone. But the railroad never received permission to build in the park, and so Quinn says visitors had to find another way to get around.
For approximately $50, they purchased a 5.5-day trip through the park, and that tour took place on stagecoaches. They stayed at hotels that were placed 30 to 40 miles apart from each other because that's the distance they could travel in a stagecoach in a day.
Architect Robert C. Reamer designed the Old Faithful Inn, which was built during the winter of 1903-1904. The building is constructed almost entirely from logs. In the lobby, you can look up and see balconies and walkways made from gnarled and oddly shaped pieces of polished wood. Frankly, it looks like a gargantuan treehouse. Ruth Quinn took us on a short tour of the inn, beginning with the original part of the building.
You're going to take us into one of the historic bedrooms?
Yes, we'll look at one of the rooms. The Old Faithful Inn was built between 1903 and 1904, and in the original part of the building, we attempt to keep the rooms looking like they looked when people stayed here in 1904.
The room is very small. The double bed takes up most of it. The walls are polished pine. There's a copper-topped wash basin, end table, and one of the windows looks out toward the geyser. We return to the main lobby. It's packed with tourists. Nearby, the Old Faithful geyser has just erupted, and the crowds have moved inside, where they now clog the aisles in the gift shop. Ruth Quinn points out some of the lobby's main features and again emphasizes architect Robert Reamer's desire to bring the outdoors in.
He built the lobby to be 76.5 feet tall. Mature lodgepole pines in Yellowstone average about 75 feet tall. So the lobby measures the height of a lodgepole pine forest.
Reamer sent men out into the forest to find all those twisted and knotted pieces of wood for the inn's balustrades and railings. The warped shapes were meant to create the feeling of branches. A massive 6-story stone fireplace and chimney dominate the southeast corner of the lobby. In the 105 years since the inn was built, it has undergone several restoration projects, but perhaps the most important of these came in 1987, when the inn's original sprinkler system was updated. There was now a deluge component on the roof, which would soak the inn should a fire ever threaten it. And 1 year later, on September 7, 1988, the system was put to the test. 20 years ago today, a wall of flames approached the Old Faithful area. High winds and dry conditions pushed the fire toward the geyser basin, tossing out embers the size of fists. Bob Barbie was the park superintendent in 1988.
I met with the fire commanders who were in charge of that fire and said, you know, there's a lot of things that can burn in Yellowstone, and it's probably of no great consequence. But the Old Faithful Inn is the Sistine Chapel, so to speak. And under any circumstances, we don't lose the Old Faithful Inn. And if we do, I'm dead meat, and so are you.
Firefighters worked furiously to protect the Old Faithful Inn. They draped hoses over the exterior and drenched the building, hoping to make the wooden structure as fireproof as possible. The new deluge system was employed. Helicopters flew overhead, dousing the approaching flames. By late in the day, the main front of the fire no longer threatened the Old Faithful area. And while several small cabins had burned, the inn remained standing, with only minor damage. To see photos of the Old Faithful Inn and hear the story of Jeff Henry, a photographer who was there on September 7th, 1988, visit our website at npr.org. Next week, we continue our series on Yellowstone National Park. We'll hear from Roy Rankin. He's a vegetation management specialist with the park and he'll explain the important role fires play in Yellowstone's ecosystem. And another sign that summer is over. In a moment, we'll speak to Captain Fatty Goodlander, the editor-at-large of Cruising World magazine, as we wrap up our summer sailing series. But first, his final communique.
You know, I realize that being an eternal sea gypsy is kind of tough on my kid. I'm sympathetic to that fact, and I imagine how it must be for our daughter, Roma Orion, at Brandeis University, working two jobs, one in the convenience store and the other one in the cafeteria, to support herself, and for her to be getting daily emails from her sailing parents like, "Whoa, the 151 rum is only a buck a quart here in Madagascar." Or, "We almost drowned in the communal kava bowl last night in Vanuatu." Yes, being a child of sea gypsies isn't easy. Once we got an angry email from Roma Orion, which read, "When you get a chance, dear parents, please tell me what country you are currently in, or at least which continent you are on. It's kind of embarrassing telling my friends I don't know if you're in Asia or Africa, or bobbing off some small island in between." Of course, she visits. As an adult, she's cruised with us in French Polynesia, the entire Great Barrier Reef of Australia, and Africa as well. But the fact of the matter is, we're different generations with different criteria and different aspirations. The world truly is our oyster. Distance and time mean nothing to us. What's a passage of a few months at sea when being at sea is exactly where we want to be? But our daughter, of course, she worries. She has a fancy apartment and so many bills she needs Quicken to keep track of them. We have, however, only one annual bill, $250 a year to pay for our shipboard email account. We have absolutely no other bills, no monthly bills, no weekly bills. Sure, we dearly love our daughter, and sure, she loves us very much. But we raised her to think for herself, even knowing that, as we did so, that someday, if we were successful in that quest, that someday she'd think different than us. And so she does, and more power to her. She has an MBA, a PDA, an IRA, Lord knows what else. Her life is an alphabet soup. We have very little, and we want less. Thus we sail and sail and sail.
That's Captain Fatty Goodlander aboard his sailboat, the Wild Card. He's anchored off Phuket, Thailand, and he joins us. Ahoy, Captain Fatty.
Ahoy, Leanne.
I understand that you actually had your newly married daughter, Roma Orion, and her husband on board. What was that like?
Well, we spent 2 weeks cruising with them in Phang Nga Bay, which is very close to Phuket, and it was absolutely fantastic. We didn't know our husband that well, and now he's family. A small boat is a great place to bond, and the sailing here is just absolutely otherworldly with the very, very impressive geographical, geological formations in Phang Nga Bay, and we laughed and laughed and laughed. And if you can laugh together as a family in such tight quarters, I think that's where it's at. And we just had a marvelous time. She sailed with us in Tahiti and in Australia and in Africa, in the Virgin Islands, of course. And it was just wonderful to have the whole family united, and even better now because we have a wonderful addition, Christian Rojas.
So in the last 3 months, you've sailed to the Philippines, Borneo, Brunei, Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand. Well, what would you say you've learned from the people and the places you visited?
Well, the nobility of some of these people in Thailand and the Philippines just absolutely blows my mind. If I was half as good as a human being as most of them are, I'd be very happy and proud. Mm-hmm. And, we just sailed past a rice paddy where there was a fella, farming his rice. And he's, it's so easy for me on a sophisticated yacht with GPS and internet connections to think I'm really sophisticated and he's really primitive, that he hasn't evolved for 1,000 years because he's been working that field with his water buffalo all that time. But in reality, he's been feeding his family and his life's been in balance and his irrigation has got the correct number of frogs in it. And he's still being able to provide a livelihood for his family after thousands of years. And I'm not sure that my culture is doing all that great. Seems like it's burning through this planet fairly quickly.
Where do you sail to next?
Next, we're we're going to be here for a couple of months. We've got lots of writing projects in the works. Next up is India, and then we have the big decision whether to go back to Africa, which we love very much, or up the Red Sea to the Med. We would like to go to the Med because we'd like to be able to visit our daughter who is moving to Spain, and it would be a really cool new destination for us. On the other hand, the Med is an expensive place. Every time you go into a harbor, it costs you a little bit of money, and I can live literally like a king in Southeast Asia and Africa for almost nothing. So that's a big consideration for us.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a lot of fun being on this voyage with you this summer. So take care in your travels, okay?
Thank you very much, and I wish you and all the NPR listeners the very best. Fair winds and calm seas, mind the rudder, or meet the rock.
Captain Fatty Goodlander is the editor-at-large of Cruising World magazine. You can read more about his adventures at npr.org. The American presidential election is a hot topic around the globe, especially in the United Kingdom, perhaps because of the close alliance between the two countries. Diane Roberts has this essay on how the Republican National Convention and the rest of the campaign has been playing in the UK.
American politics fascinate the British. All that bluster, all that money. The British media did a pretty thorough job of covering the conventions, considering that, one, there's a six-hour time difference, so the big speeches happen at 4 a.m., and two, the British don't have a vote. But when Alaska Governor Sarah Palin came rip-roaring into their consciousness straight from central casting, they were hooked. Reporters from the BBC and other news outfits stalked St. Paul's Xcel Energy Center, listening to delegates gush about her. It was as if she were the newly revealed love child of Teddy Roosevelt and Margaret Thatcher. It's no wonder Sarah Palin has dominated the front pages. She embodies all that is exotic and inexplicable about America. She's a beauty queen. She's an evangelical. She comes from a far-off land of majestic mountains, big skies, bears, bridges to nowhere, oil pipelines, and all the caribou you can shoot. Several newspaper columnists said she's right out of one of their favorite American TV shows, Northern Exposure. The Democrats, on the other hand, put the British powerfully in mind of the West Wing. Barack Obama is Matthew Santos, declared the Daily Telegraph. You know, the Jimmy Smits character, the earnest and eloquent candidate who pledges to unite a bitterly divided nation. But this past week, the Republicans held the stage. This is, after all, the weirdest American election since the millennial mess of 2000. And Sarah Palin is the new star. Her hair, her clothes, the names of her children, which one British columnist said sound like characters in an Australian soap opera, have been big news for days, as has her penchant for moose hunting. There's a little problem with that moose hunting, though. It reminds the British of yet another one of their favorite TV shows. See, the only moose most of them know is Bullwinkle. And I can tell you they don't like the idea of him being made into a stew. Rocky wouldn't like it either. They do love animals here.
Diane Roberts is a frequent contributor to Weekend Edition. She's spending this campaign season in London.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Lydon. Hillary Clinton has one definition of feminism. Here she is on the campaign trail in January.
We obviously still have problems of gender equality. You know, equal pay is not yet equal.
Right.
A woman makes 77 cents on a dollar, and women of color make 67 cents.
Sarah Palin exemplifies a much different brand of feminism. Since 2006, she's been a member of the anti-abortion rights organization Feminists for Life. Last week, of course, the governor accepted the Republican nomination for vice president. In doing so, she said her parents raised her with a simple idea.
That this is America, and every woman can walk through every door of opportunity, and my parents are here tonight.
Democrats and Republicans are both
sounding very much like would-be feminists.
That's Professor Estelle Friedman. She teaches history at Stanford University and wrote the book No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Women. In a campaign season in which language is appropriated and reappropriated, I asked her if both Senator Hillary Clinton and Governor Sarah Palin could be feminists.
That really gets to the heart of what is a feminist. And it's a very malleable term. It historically, and I should say the term only, is used after the late 19th century. But if we use it ahistorically in all the women's rights movements and all the historical movements for women's full humanity, for education, spiritual equality, and the like, there have been varieties of feminism. It's liberal, radical, socialist, ecofeminism. Can there be conservative feminism? That is an interesting question right now. Because conservative women have mobilized in the United States certainly since the 1920s. There have been a strong movement of women against communism, against sex education in the schools, for strong national defense. Think Phyllis Schlafly. But until now, they didn't call themselves feminists.
Well, in fact, I was thinking of Phyllis Schlafly,
yes,
particularly when she began the Eagle Forum.
Yes.
She did not like the term feminism, and for a long time, conservative activists who were women didn't seem to use it, and now it seems that it's being embraced.
I think you're making a very good point, and I think that there's several ways of understanding that. One is that there are some conservative women who agree with parts of feminist politics from a libertarian individual rights position and who sincerely see a link between equal opportunity and their classic conservative politics. That is, everyone should have opportunity, but individuals rather than government. Then I think there's a more cynical or a more politically exploitative use, which is to sort of subvert or appropriate the feminist label and to say, because I'm a woman and I agree with the conservative policies, I'm going to call myself a feminist and I'm going to therefore try to bring in women's votes. And so some of it I think may be sincere in agreement, and some of it really may be more appropriative, if not subverting, the term feminist.
The question of womanhood is heavily at play this election season. Is there more pressure today for female candidates to be both feminine and powerful?
Yes, I think you're right. I think that what you're raising is the question of gender, that is, masculinity and femininity. Not just are you a woman or a man, but how do you present yourself in gendered terms? So note that Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, while they have very different politics, have both had to adopt, to an extent, a certain masculinist identity. You have to be a hunter, for example. That's not what earlier generations of women in politics, conservative or liberal, would have had to do.
So Hillary drinks a beer, Sarah Palin holds up a shotgun.
Yes. And I would also say that is interesting in terms of men in the campaign, too, not just in this campaign, but that men are walking a slightly different line now. I think in some ways John McCain is more of the traditional, the military background and the strong defense fit into traditional notions of masculinity, whereas Barack Obama, as an African-American man, has a real challenge. I think some of the criticisms of Obama as being too aloof or being not going after red meat enough or not being aggressive enough are really questioning his masculinity in some ways. But given the historic stereotypes about fear of African-American men's masculinity, fears of their aggression, really he is, I think, been successful partly because he embodies an earlier model of black male politicians for whom respectability and reason were tickets into full citizenship. And yet you have people almost baiting him to try to be more macho. So I think that the gender issue has affected both women and men, at least outsiders, let's put it that way. I think perhaps white male politicians may be less confronted with the issue, but women, African-American, and perhaps other minority group men may have to navigate that gender line differently.
As a historian, is Sarah Palin a singular figure? Have we seen anyone else like her?
She combines elements of earlier conservative women who have been for strong national defense but limited government spending for social issues, But I do think that she is of a younger generation who can assume that she can aspire to do anything. And I think that's different than an earlier generation of conservative women.
Estelle Friedman is the author of No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Women. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Since John McCain picked Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate, reporters from the national media have flocked to Alaska to dig into her career and family life. Michael Carey is a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News in Alaska. He has the advantage of having followed Sarah Palin's political career for a number of years, and he joins us. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
You've written that she was very adept at using the media while campaigning for governor and that she ran on, quote, who she was rather than the issues. And at times she was called a cult figure. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I had her in debate on television. I was the moderator of several debates, and it was quite clear that she was very, very good. And whether she had been schooled or was sort of natural in it, I never figured out. And during the campaign, it was the same kind of thing. She came from nowhere and did very, very well. She'd run for lieutenant governor before and lost, but that race really didn't get much attention.
The governor is known for going up against the political establishment, even within her own party. But on the other hand, she has been close to Senator Ted Stevens over the course of her career. How would you characterize her relationship with the party establishment in Alaska?
Well, there are two things. One is the party establishment, and the other is Ted Stevens. People find it, given the partisanship that exists in the rest of the country, hard to understand that her biggest problem in Alaska has been with the most conservative elite Republicans and the oil industry. It hasn't been with the Democrats. She's worked well with the Democrats in the legislature, legislation that has passed that she wanted with their assistance, and it's crucial to her to have the Democrats up there. The speech she gave the other day, the partisanship and the attacks on Obama and Harry Reid, was very uncharacteristic of her and, in my own judgment, was probably inserted by some guys who think they're very smart and are from Washington.
She is the subject of an ethics investigation over allegations that she used the influence of her office to have the state's public safety commissioner fired. Where does that investigation stand now, given that on Friday we heard that seven potential witnesses have canceled their meetings with the investigators and they'll now be subpoenaed?
This investigation is, as many do, taking on a life of its own and is becoming much different than it was at the beginning when it was there were questions that were, I think, fairly straightforward about whether she had violated the Ethics Act or done something improperly. I think listeners need to remember something else in evaluating this. Her complaints about Trooper Wooten, her former brother-in-law, who she thought was a danger to her family, began before she was governor of Alaska. So some of what she has done is as a private citizen that any private citizen could do, and other activities or interventions are as governor.
Well, Alaska lawmakers are saying the investigation will be completed 3 weeks earlier than originally scheduled,
right,
basically to avoid, I guess, an October surprise. Do you think they'll be able to complete it in time?
I do not know Steve Branchflower, the investigator personally, or the counsel who's investigating. He has a very good reputation, is very well known in the legal community in Anchorage. I think he's going to face the biggest press conference of his life when he comes out with the findings, that this has gone from something that was a provincial matter to a matter of national interest in just a few days.
Is there any pressure on the legislature to back off the investigation?
I talked to Senator Hollis French, the Senate Judiciary Chairman. He argues that we hired the investigator or the special counsel, whatever term you wish to use, and he's doing the investigation, and that's it. His results will be what they are. And if the Republicans had appointed the special counsel, then the Democrats would be arguing, I guess.
Michael Carey is a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.